Chapter 2. O Rus, Horace. O Rus. The place Eugene found so confining was quite a lovely country nest, where one who favoured soft reclining would thank his stars to be so blessed. The manor house, in proud seclusion, screened by a hill from wind's intrusion, stood by a river. Far away, green meads and golden cornfields lay, lit by the sun as it paraded. Small hamlets, too, the eye could see, and cattle wandering o'er the lea, while near at hand, all dense and shaded, a vast neglected garden made a nook where pensive dryads played. The ancient manse had been erected for placid comfort, and to last, and all its solid form reflected the sense and taste of ages past. Throughout the house the ceilings towered, from walls ancestral portraits glowered. The drawing-room had rich brocades and stoves of tile in many shades. All this today seems antiquated, I don't know why, but in the end it hardly mattered to my friend, for he had become so fully jaded he yawned alike where'er he sat, in ancient hall or modern flat. He settled where the former squire for 40 years had heaved his sighs, had cursed the cook in useless ire, stared out the window and squashed flies. The furnishings were plain but stable, a couch, two cupboards and a table, no spot of ink on oaken floors. Onegin opened cupboard doors and found in one a list of wages, some fruit liqueurs and applejack, and in the next an almanac from 1808 with tattered pages. The busy master never took a glance in any other book. Alone amid his new possessions, and merely as an idle scheme, Eugene devised a few concessions and introduced a new regime. A backwoods genius, he commuted the old corvée and substituted a quitrent at a modest rate. His peasants thanked their lucky fate, but thrifty neighbours waxed indignant and in their dens bewailed as one the dreadful harm of what he'd done. Still others sneered or turned malignant, and everyone who chose to speak called him a menace and a freak. At first the neighbours' calls were steady, but when they learned that in the rear Onegin kept his stallion ready so that he could quickly disappear the moment one of them was sighted or heard approaching uninvited, they took offence, and, one and all, they dropped him cold and ceased to call. "The man's a bore. He's off his rocker. Must be a mason. Drinks, they say. Red wine by tumbler, night and day. Won't kiss a lady's hand, the mocker. Won't call me sir the way he should." The general verdict wasn't good. Another squire chose this season to reappear at his estate and gave the neighbours equal reason for scrutiny no less irate. Vladimir Lensky, just returning from Göttingen with soulful yearning, was in his prime, a handsome youth and poet filled with Kantian truth. From misty Germany our squire had carried back the fruits of art, a freedom-loving, noble heart, a spirit strange but full of fire, an always bold, impassioned speech, and raven locks of shoulder reach. As yet unmarked by disillusion or chill corruption's deadly grasp, his soul still knew the warm effusion of maiden's touch and friendship's clasp. A charming fool at love's vocation, he fed on hope's eternal ration. The world's fresh glitter and its call still held his youthful mind in thrall. He entertained with fond illusions the doubts that plagued his heart and will. The goal of life, he found, was still a tempting riddle of confusions. He racked his brains and rather thought that miracles could still be wrought. He knew a kindred soul was fated to join her life to his career, that even now she pined and waited, expecting he would soon appear. and he believed that men would tender their freedom for his honour's splendour, that friendly hands would surely rise to shatter slander's cup of lies, that there exists a holy cluster of chosen ones whom men should heed, a happy and immortal breed, whose potent light in all its lustre would one day shine upon our race and grant the world redeeming grace. Compassion, noble indignation, a perfect love of righteous ways, and fame's delicious agitation had stirred his soul since early days. He roamed the world with singing lyre, and found the source of lyric fire beneath the skies of distant lands, from Goethe's and from Schiller's hands. He never shamed, the happy creature, the lofty muses of his art. He proudly sang, with open heart, sublime emotions every feature, the charm of gravely simple things, and youthful hopes on youthful wings. He sang of love. By love commanded, a simple and affecting tune, as clear as maiden thoughts, as candid as infant slumber, as the moon in heaven's peaceful desert flying, that queen of secrets and of sighing. He sang of parting and of pain, of something vague, of mists and rain. He sang the rose, romantic flower, and distant lands where once he'd shed his living tears upon the bed of silence at a lonely hour. He sang life's bloom gone pale and sere. He had almost reached his 18th year. Throughout that barren, dim dominion, Eugene alone could see his worth. And Lenski formed a low opinion of neighbours' feasts and rounds of mirth. He fled their noisy congregations and found their solemn conversations of liquor and of hay brought in, of kennels and of distant kin, devoid of any spark of feeling or hint of inner lyric grace. Both wit and brains were out of place, as were the arts of social dealing. But then their charming wives, he found, at talk, were even less profound. Well off, and handsome in addition, young Lenski seemed the perfect catch. And so, by countryside tradition, they asked him round and sought to match their daughters with this semi-Russian. He'd call, and right away discussion would touch obliquely on the point that bachelors' lives were out of joint, and then the guest would be invited to take some tea while Dunya poured. They whisper, "Dunya, don't look bored." Then bring in her guitar, excited, and then, good God, she'd start to bawl, "Come to my golden chamber hall." But Lenski, having no desire for marriage bonds or wedding bell, had cordial hopes that he'd acquire the chance to know Onegin well. And so they met, like wave with mountain, like verse with prose, like flame with fountain, their natures distant and apart. At first, their differences of heart made meetings dull at one another's, but then their friendship grew, and soon they'd meet on horse each afternoon, and in the end were close as brothers. Thus people, so it seems to me, become good friends from sheer ennui. But even friendships like our heroes exist no more, for we've outgrown all sentiments and deem men zeros, except, of course, ourselves alone. We all take on Napoleon's features, and millions of our fellow creatures are nothing more to us than tools, since feelings are for freaks and fools. Eugene, of course, had keen perceptions and, on the whole, despised mankind, yet wasn't, like so many, blind. And since each rule permits exceptions, he did respect a noble few, and, cold himself, gave warmth its due. He smiled at Lenski's conversation, indeed the poet's fervent speech, his gaze of constant inspiration, his mind still vacillant in reach. All these were new and unexpected, and so, for once, Eugene elected to keep his wicked tongue in check and thought, What foolishness to wreck the young man's blissful, brief infection. Its time will pass without my knife, so let him meanwhile live his life believing in the world's perfection. Let's grant to fevered youthful days their youthful ravings and their blaze. The two found everything a basis for argument or food for thought, the covenants of bygone races, the fruits that learned science brought, the prejudice that haunts all history, the grave's eternal fateful mystery, and good and evil, life and fate, on each in turn they'd ruminate. The poet, lost in hot contention, would oft recite, his eyes ablaze, brief passages from Nordic lays. Eugene, with friendly condescension, would listen with a look intense, although he seldom saw their sense. More often, though, my two recluses would muse on passions and their flights. Eugene, who'd fled their wild abuses, regretted still his past delights and sighed, recalling their interment. Oh, happy he who's known the ferment of passions and escaped their lot! More happy he who knew them not, who cooled off love with separation and enmity with harsh contempt, who yawned with wife and friends, exempt from pangs of jealous agitation, who never risked his sound estate upon a deuce, that cunning bait. When we at last turn into sages and flock to tranquil wisdom's crest, when passion's flame no longer rages and all the yearnings in our breast, the wayward fits, the final surges, have all become mere comic urges, and pain has made us humble men, we sometimes like to listen then as others tell of passion's swelling. They stir our hearts and fan the flame. Just so a soldier, old and lame, forgotten in his wretched dwelling, will strain to hear with bated breath the young blood's yarns of courting death. But flaming youth in all its madness keeps nothing of its heart concealed. Its loves and hates, its joy and sadness, are babbled out and soon revealed. Onegin, who was widely taken as one whom love had left forsaken, would listen gravely to the end when self-expression gripped his friend. The poet, feasting on confession, naively poured his secrets out. And so Eugene learned all about the course of youthful love's progression, a story rich in feelings too, although to us they're hardly new. Ah, yes, he loved in such a fashion as men today no longer do, as only poets, mad with passion, still love, because they're fated to. He knew one constant source of dreaming, one constant wish forever gleaming, one ever-present cause for pain, and neither distance nor the chain of endless years of separation, nor pleasure's rounds, nor learning's well, nor foreign beauty's magic spell, nor yet the muse, his true vocation, could alter Lenski's deep desire, his soul aflame with virgin fire. When scarce a boy, and not yet knowing the torment of a heart in flames, he'd been entranced by Olga growing, and fondly watched her girlhood games. Beneath a shady park's protection, he cheered her frolics with affection. Their fathers, who were friends, had plans to read one day their marriage bans, and deep within her rustic bower, beneath her parents' loving gaze, she blossomed in a maiden's ways, a valley lily come to flower, off where the grass grows dense and high, unseen by bee or butterfly. She gave the poet intimations of youthful ecstasies unknown, and filling all his meditations, drew forth his flute's first ardent moan. Farewell, O golden game's illusion! He fell in love with dark seclusion, with stillness, stars, the lonely night, and with the moon's celestial light, that lamp to which we've consecrated 1,000 walks in evening's calm and countless tears, the gentle balm of secret torments unabated. Today, though all we see in her is just another lantern's blur. forever modest, meek in bearing, as gay as morning's rosy dress, like any poet, open, caring, as sweet as love's own soft caress, her sky-blue eyes, devoid of guile, her flaxen curls, her lovely smile, her voice, her form, her graceful stance. Oh, Olga's every trait! But glance in any novel, you'll discover her portrait there. It's charming, true. I liked it once, no less than you. But round it, boredom seems to hover. And so, dear reader, grant me pause to plead her elder sister's cause. Her sister bore the name Tatiana, and we now press our willful claim to be the first who thus shall honour a tender novel with that name. Why not? I like its intonation. It has, I know, association with olden days beyond recall, with humble roots and servants' hall. But we must grant, though it offend us, our taste in names is less than weak. Of verses I won't even speak. Enlightenment has failed to mend us, and all we've learned from its great store is affectation, nothing more. So she was called Tatiana, reader. She lacked that fresh and rosy tone that made her sister's beauty sweeter and drew all eyes to her alone. A wild creature, sad and pensive, shy as a doe and apprehensive, Tatiana seemed among her kin a stranger who had wandered in. She never learned to show affection, to hug her parents, either one. A child herself, for children's fun, she lacked the slightest predilection, and oftentimes she'd sit all day in silence at the window bay. But pensiveness, her friend and treasure through all her years since cradle days, adorned the course of rural leisure by bringing dreams before her gaze. She never touched a fragile finger to thread a needle, wouldn't linger above a tambour to enrich a linen cloth with silken stitch. Mark how the world compels submission. The little girl with docile doll prepares in play for protocol, for every social admonition, and to her doll, without demur, repeats what Mama taught to her. But dolls were never Tanya's passion. When she was small, she didn't choose to talk to them of clothes or fashion or tell them all the city news. And she was not the sort who glories in girlish pranks, but grisly stories quite charmed her heart when they were told on winter nights all dark and cold. Whenever Nanny brought together young Olga's friends to spend the day, Tatiana never joined their play or games of tag upon the heather, for she was bored by all their noise, their laughing shouts and giddy joys. Upon her balcony appearing, she loved to greet Aurora's show, when dancing stars are disappearing against the heaven's pallid glow, when earth's horizon softly blushes, and wind, the morning's herald, rushes, and slowly day begins its flight. In winter, when the shade of night still longer half the globe encumbers, and neath the misty moon on high an idle stillness rules the sky, and late the lazy east still slumbers, awakened early nonetheless, by candlelight she'd rise and dress. From early youth she read romances, and novels set her heart aglow. She loved the fictions and the fancies of Richardson and of Rousseau. Her father was a kindly fellow, lost in a past he found more mellow, but still in books he saw no harm, and though immune to reading's charm, deemed it a minor peccadillo. Nor did he care what secret tome his daughter read or kept at home, asleep till morn beneath her pillow. His wife herself, we ought to add, for Richardson was simply mad. It wasn't that she'd read him, really, nor was it that she much preferred to Lovelace Grandison, but merely that long ago she'd often heard her Moscow cousin, Princess Laura, go on about their special aura. Her husband at the time was still her fiancé, against her will, for she, in spite of family feeling, had someone else for whom she pined, a man whose heart and soul and mind she found a great deal more appealing. This Grandison was fashion's pet, a gambler, and a guards cadet. About her clothes, one couldn't fault her. Like him, she dressed as taste decreed. But then they led her to the altar and never asked if she agreed. The clever husband chose correctly to take his grieving bride directly to his estate, where first she cried, with God knows whom on every side, then tossed about and seemed demented, and almost even left her spouse. But then she took to keeping house and settled down and grew contented. Thus heaven's gift to us is this, that habit takes the place of bliss. 'Twas only habit, then, that taught her the way to master rampant grief, and soon a great discovery brought her a final and complete relief. Betwixt her chores and idle hours, she learned to use her woman's powers to rule the house as autocrat, and life went smoothly after that. She'd drive around to check the workers. She pickled mushrooms for the fall. She made her weekly bathhouse call. She kept the books. She shaved the shirkers. She beat the maids when she was cross, and left her husband at a loss. She used to write with blood quotations in maidens' albums, thought it keen to speak in sing-song intonations, would call Praskovya, chère Pauline. She laced her corset very tightly, pronounced a Russian N as slightly as un in French and through the nose. But soon she dropped her city pose, the corsets, albums, chic relations. The sentimental verses, too, were quite forgot. She bid adieu to all her foreign affectations and took at last to coming down in just her cap and quilted gown. And yet her husband loved her dearly. In all her schemes he'd never probe. He trusted all she did sincerely and ate and drank in just his robe. His life flowed on, quite calm and pleasant, with kindly neighbours sometimes present, for hearty talk at evenfall, just casual friends who'd often call to shake their heads, to prate and prattle, to laugh a bit at something new, and time would pass, till Olga'd brew some tea to whet their tittle-tattle, then supper came, then time for bed, and off the guests would drive, well fed. Amid this peaceful life they cherished, they held all ancient customs dear. At Shrovetide feasts their table flourished with Russian pancakes, Russian cheer. Twice yearly, too, they did their fasting, were fond of songs for fortune casting, of choral dances, garden swings. At Trinity, when service brings the people yawning in for prayer, they'd shed a tender tear or two upon their buttercups of rue. They needed kvass no less than air, and at their table guests were served by rank, in turn, as each deserved. And thus they aged, as do all mortals, until at last the husband found that death had opened wide its portals, through which he entered newly crowned. He died at midday's break from labour, lamented much by friend and neighbour, by children and by faithful wife, far more than some who part this life. He was a kind and simple barin. And there, where now his ashes lie, a tombstone tells the passer-by, "The humble sinner Dmitri Larin, a slave of God and brigadier, beneath this stone now resteth here." Restored to home and its safe-keeping, young Lenski came to cast an eye upon his neighbour's place of sleeping, and mourned his ashes with a sigh. And long he stood in sorrow aching. "Poor Yorick," then he murmured, shaking, "how oft within his arms I lay, how oft in childhood days I'd play with his Ochakov decoration. He destined Olga for my wife, and used to say, 'Oh, grant me life to see the day.'" In lamentation, right then and there, Vladimir penned a funeral verse for his old friend. And then, with verse of quickened sadness, he honoured too, in tears and pain, his parents' dust, their memory's gladness. Alas, upon life's furrowed plain, a harvest brief, each generation, by fate's mysterious dispensation, arises, ripens, and must fall. Then others too must heed the call, for thus our giddy race gains power. It waxes, stirs, turns seething wave, then crowds its forebears toward the grave. And we as well shall face that hour, when one fine day our grandsons true straight out of life will crowd us too. So, meanwhile, friends, enjoy your blessing, this fragile life that hurries so. Its worthlessness needs no professing, and I'm not loath to let it go. I've closed my eyes to phantoms gleaming, yet distant hopes within me dreaming still stir my heart at times to flight. I'd grieve to quit this world's dim light and leave no trace, however slender. I live, I write, not seeking fame, and yet I think I'd wish to claim for my sad lot its share of splendour, at least one note to linger long, recalling, like some friend, my song. And it may touch some heart with fire, and thus preserved by fate's decree, the stanza fashioned by my lyre may yet not drown in Lethe's sea. Perhaps, a flattering hope's illusion, some future dunce with warm effusion will point my portrait out and plead, "This was a poet, yes, indeed." Accept my thanks and admiration, you lover of the muse's art. O you whose mind shall know by heart the fleeting works of my creation, whose cordial hand shall then be led to pat the old man's laureled head.